Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome you all for our third oral argument today. We have students here with us from Monroe High School. Would they please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. Now, the story I get, which may not be absolutely accurate, is you all were wandering down the hallway, and you were snared by the deputy marshal, who said, by all means, come in and hear this oral argument. Anywhere close to the truth?
No.
Right. No, they say. All right. Well, we're delighted to welcome you. And as you all know, we have an arrangement with the State Bar of Wisconsin that we invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. And part of that is that they get some materials from us relating to the oral argument. They come, and at lunchtime between the second and third arguments, they meet with a justice assigned for that day. And I gather you did not meet with the justice. And I'll try and arrange that a justice meet with you right after this oral argument if you have time to stay. And I gather you do. The other thing we have for everyone is a summary of the case we are about to hear. And if you would like a summary of that case, would you raise your hand? Have all the students gotten a summary? Okay, fine. Good. Anyone else want a summary of the case? That's good. Well, welcome, and we're delighted to have you here, and we'll try and arrange for a meeting. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. He had been assigned. We'll see if he's willing to do it again later. Justice Patience Robinsack sitting next to him.
Michael Gableman's not participating.
Ah, sorry. There's an empty chair, which I didn't look at. He is not participating. There's another empty chair on this side of the bench. Justice David Prosser is not participating. So we have empty chair, Patience Robinsack. Seated to my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, an empty chair, and on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. I think I got it right that time. And so I will call the next case, 11AP2864CRAC, State versus Samuel Curtis Johnson III. Arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin is Marguerite M. Moore, Assistant Attorney General. Counsel?
May it please the court. This matter is here on the state's petition to review a decision of the Court of Appeals for District 2, affirming in part and reversing in part a pretrial order of the Racine County Circuit Court. All three members of the Court of Appeals agreed with the Circuit Court's determination that the defendant, Johnson, had made the preliminary showing of materiality required by State v. Shifra and State v. Green, entitling him to a pretrial in-camera review of the counseling records of the alleged victim, his minor stepdaughter, T.S. A majority of the court found that because T.S. declined to consent to the in-camera review of her records, that she would be barred from testifying against Johnson at trial. The majority therefore reversed that portion of the circuit court's decision, which would have allowed T.S. to testify despite her refusal to consent to in-camera review, and would have required an instruction telling the jury that T.S. had the right to refuse, that she exercised that right, and that the jury was free to infer that the content of the records would have been unfavorable to the state or favorable to the defense. Judge Brown disagreed with both the majority and the circuit court on this point. He agreed with the state's argument that the circuit court could obtain access to TS's records for in-camera review despite her non-consent, and the court could examine them to see if they contained any information that had to be disclosed to the defense. Before this court are three questions. First, should this court overrule State versus Shifra because it wrongly created a federal due process right to discovery of privately held privileged records that conflicts with United States Supreme Court jurisprudence? Secondly, if this court declines to overrule Shifra's due process holding, should this court nevertheless reject Shifra's remedy of witness preclusion and instead hold that where a defendant has made the preliminary showing of materiality, a trial court can order production of the records without the witness's consent? And finally, under the current state of the law, did Johnson make the preliminary showing of materiality required under Shifra Green? If the Court of Appeals decision is allowed to stand, a self-admitted child molester will escape prosecution because the stepdaughter he is accused of molesting over a 3-year period has decided that she does not want a trial judge to review her privileged records, which, under the current state of the law, is a decision she is entitled to make. The state submits that this court can and should prevent that from happening. The first way to prevent that from happening is to overrule Shifra and its progeny, because Shifra erroneously extrapolated from precedent that was based on the state's duty to disclose under Brady versus Maryland and similar cases exculpatory evidence in its possession.
Counsel,
yes.
Even if you're right that Shifra did not properly rely on Ritchie in the difference between private records and government records, I look at the brief of the defense, and with regard to the request to overrule Shifra, the appendix table, contents, page 61, lists a number of cases where the state has appeared before this court and said, please overrule Shifra for the very reasons you're advancing again here today. Why shouldn't we say, well, maybe Shifra got it right, maybe it wasn't exactly right, but enough's enough when we've gone through Spies and Behnke, Menez and Solberg and Navarro and Green. I mean, you've asked us a lot. Why should, is the 12th time the charm here, you know?
I agree that the state has been persistent in its efforts to get Shifra overruled. I don't think that in any of the previous cases, this court or the Court of Appeals, for that matter, in its cases in which we have asked that Shifra be modified, has ever really come to grips with the idea that there cannot be a federal due process right to discover privileged records held by a third party when courts throughout the country, and those decisions are collected in an annotation that is cited, I believe, at page 17 of our brief, has held that there is no due process or other constitutional right to compel any kind of a pretrial deposition of a witness in a criminal case. And those cases spring from decisions of the United States Supreme Court, Weatherford versus Bercy, Wardius versus Oregon, in which the United States Supreme Court has declared that the Due Process Clause of the federal Constitution has very little to say about pretrial discovery. Pretrial discovery is usually a creature of the legislature or court rules. The Due Process Clause only requires discovery insofar as information is in the possession of the government or a state, and that information is exculpatory, which means it can go to the guilt or innocence or the punishment factor of a defendant. And those are the only situations in which the United States Supreme Court has held that there is any due process right. So insofar as SHFRA created this right, it really did so by relying on cases that are decided in a totally different context. If you look at Weatherford versus Bercy, even though that was a 1983 action, the court there held that the state would have no duty to disclose to a defendant even the names of unfavorable witnesses before trial. And what that means as a practical matter is that the state could not turn over, and again, we're talking about only in the constitutional sense, not under state statutory discovery rules, the state could not turn over the names of witnesses, and the defendant would be unable to investigate those witnesses' past backgrounds, and yet there would be no violation of the Due Process Clause. So how can it be that if there is no federal due process right to obtain even unprivileged information, that there can be such a right to obtain an in-camera review and potential disclosure of privileged information that the state is not privy to, that is not in the possession of the state or any kind of state agency? It's our position that SHFRA and cases decided after SHFRA are wrong insofar as they extrapolate from Ritchie to a situation where the state does not have any access to the evidence the defendant is trying to obtain.
Counsel, we have opined on that many times. Let me move to something that we perhaps haven't opined on, and that is the issue of whether the sanction of witness preclusion is an appropriate sanction when the holder of the privilege refuses to waive the privilege and allow an in-camera inspection. That was the very issue that was referenced in our Spies case, and we said when addressing that question on page 613, the state argues that such a sanction violates public policy by penalizing the state for a matter not within its control. The defendant in Spies does not take up the merits, and so rather, because this issue is not posed in the case and was not fully briefed, we do not decide it. We save it for another day. So I guess that day is today, as we're addressing the issue of whether or not preclusion of the witness is the appropriate sanction.
If this court adheres to SHFRA's due process analysis, yes, then the second issue that the court needs to tackle is whether witness preclusion is an appropriate sanction where a victim or other witness refuses to consent to in-camera review of her records. The state's position is that the SHFRA line of cases simply ignores the damage that occurs to the public's right in the effective administration of justice when it allows a victim to pretty much end, to halt a prosecution in its tracks simply by saying no. I will not allow in-camera review of my records. The state is not suggesting necessarily that there is collusion in this case between TS, the minor victim, and the defendant. But in a large number of cases that come before this court and in a large number of cases that come before the circuit courts, especially domestic violence prosecutions or sexual assault cases in which the defendant is a family member of the victim, it is often the defendant who is calling the shots on whether the victim will or will not consent to in-camera review. The defendant or his allies can have a lot of influence over a victim, especially where the victim is a minor and the defendant is a member of the household. It's often the case that the parent of the victim, sad to say, aligns herself with the defendant's interests. And this court, by saying that witness preclusion is an appropriate remedy, really becomes almost complicit in that whole scheme where it allows too much power to the victim at the expense of the rights of the public. If you have a situation like we do here where a defendant has made admissions of having engaged in improper sexual conduct with his stepdaughter, and yet that same child is able to stop the prosecution in its tracks by simply saying no,
the child able to stop the prosecution in its tracks by saying no if you have admissions by the defendant?
Because those admissions are so lacking in detail. They're very general admissions. There is no way that simply allowing the testimony of the defendant's counselor in Arizona or the defendant's wife in terms of repeating what he said would establish venue, for example. There's no detail to these. So the prosecution, and I checked with the prosecutor, and I'm, as an officer of the court, free to say that this prosecution will end if T.S. is barred from testifying. Simply the defendant simply saying to his wife that he, yes, I fondled T.S.'s breasts, and based on the criminal complaint, as far as the state is aware, that is the extent of that admission, and then just generalized admissions where he says, I'm sorry for what I did to T.S., I'm sorry for what I did to the family. Those types of admissions are not sufficient to prove venue in Racine County beyond a reasonable doubt. They're also not sufficient to prove that there was repeated sexual assault of the same child, in which the state has to prove three or more violations of the statute. So even though you have the admission, it's certainly not enough to go forward with a prosecution.
Are the admissions, I don't know if that's the right word I would use, are the statements made by the defendant to the therapist in Arizona, are they under seal here?
They're not under seal.
You've not offered in your answer any detail about that. You've just offered in your answer the detail about what was said to the mother.
Well, in our brief, I believe I did mention those allegations.
Yeah, but I didn't, maybe I overlooked.
I only have what's in the record. And all that the record shows is that while Johnson was receiving treatment in Arizona, he made an admission to a counselor there, and it was very brief. It was something to the effect of he admitted that he engaged in sexual conduct, and he referred to the alleged victim as his daughter, not stepdaughter. And that, as soon as he said that, he said, that's all I want to say before I talk to my lawyer, something to that effect. So it was a very brief admission. And that, in turn, is what got the ball rolling, and the Arizona authorities contacted the Racine authorities. And so that's the extent to which I'm aware of what was said out in Arizona, and I believe that is in our brief. I don't have the exact page number. And the statements that were made to the defendant's wife, as far as, again, I'm aware, are detailed in the criminal complaint. Now, there were forensic interviews conducted of both T.S. and her mother. I have not seen those forensic interviews. The trial court did not see those forensic interviews. They were audio and visually recorded. They are not part of the record before this court.
Counsel, you do not think the remedy should be witness preclusion. My understanding is you think the remedy should be an in-camera review. Is that right? And that if the court believes it should be given to the defendant, it should be given to the defendant. Is that it?
The state's position is that if this court declines to overrule Schiffer, now that's still our lead-off argument, but if you decline to do that, then the remedy is to require the production of the records from their custodian for in-camera review. That is correct. And then after the court conducts an in-camera review, only those portions of the records that the court deems the defendant has a constitutional right to receive should be turned over, should be disclosed to the defense. So that is what our position is. The option that the trial court settled on, having this instruction to the jury just conflicts with a statute. I think it's 905.13, which basically says that you are not to tell juries that a witness has invoked a privilege, that that information is to be kept from the jury. And yet the trial court's remedy would be to tell the jury that T.S. in fact had a privilege, she declined to waive it, and that they could draw a negative inference.
Now, counsel, putting in your remedy, isn't that the same thing as really overruling Schiffer for this particular case? If
no,
you overruled Schiffer, what would the result be?
If you overruled Schiffer, there would be no right, period. So there would not be any question of pretrial and camera review. The witness preclusion overruling would only go to what do you do if it comes down to a situation where the trial court says, yes, you have made the preliminary showing of materiality, and now we're going to ask the victim whether he or she will agree to waive her privilege under 905.04, and then that person says, no, I decline to waive it. So the witness preclusion part would only come in there, and as Judge Brown says, when you get to that situation, you have found that there is a federal constitutional right in opposition to a testimonial privilege, and the constitutional right takes precedence over that, and that is when the trial court would do an in-camera review, as opposed to saying, okay, we can all pack up our bags and everybody goes home because the victim has said he or she will not allow an in-camera review.
Maybe a different order of considerations, and maybe a different order of what you're going to do. But it winds up that if the defendant makes the appropriate showing, and if he doesn't, that's the end of that anyway, if he makes the appropriate showing, then if the witness says no, because if the witness says yes, that's the end of that. If the witness says no, then there's an in-camera review and there's a determination by the court as to whether the, and I'll put it simply, and maybe therefore a little incorrectly, there'll be a determination by the court balancing the defendant's constitutional rights to make a defense with the witness's privilege under the under 905, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so we're back. So if we overrule Schiffer, we're really in your second. What the remedy is, that's what you want.
I'm sorry, if you overrule Schiffer's,
you get the remedy.
Witness preclusion remedy.
Right. You're getting to the.
Right. You still keep the due process analysis, but you allow a non-consensual in-camera review. And then at that point, the court applies an even little more stringent test than a preliminary showing of materiality and looks at the records in light of what the defense is saying, their defense to the charges will be, and decides if there's anything in there that is necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence. I see I only have 5 minutes. I would like to briefly touch, unless the court has any more questions, on the first two issues.
Well, it strikes me that this has tones that are similar to the rape shield statute and what the court does there. In the rape shield, it's probably not labeled a privilege, but it is an evidentiary rule, which the legislature enacted. And the court has read in a constitutional right of defense, which is provided in the Constitution, and said, when you make the balance there, we're going to let in evidence, even if it might not be within the rape shield statute, because the defense balances out over the victim's privileges, in quotes. Do you find any analogy?
I think there are some differences and some similarities. I think the difference is that when you're talking about a testimonial privilege, you're talking about specific statements that a victim witness has made and had thought at the time would remain between her and her counselor, therapist, doctor, whatever one of the categories of people specified in Section 90504. In contrast, the types of evidence that you're talking about under the Rape Shield Law, 972.11 sub 2, I think it is, that has nothing to do with really testimonial types of privilege. It's really evidence of prior conduct. So how a court interprets the Rape Shield statute doesn't really have an impact on whether a witness will be likely to want to go to therapy, not want to go to therapy, that type of thing. The similarities I see are that you're balancing a constitutional right on one hand, like in Pulitzano, for example,
yes,
with a state statutory right. And in that sense, the similarity is that this court has found that there are limited situations in which a state statute, in that case the Rape Shield Law, does have to bow to the superior right of a defendant's, you know, constitutional entitlement to something. So I think there are similarities and differences between those two situations.
Counselor, how is the viewing of these records, how is that relevant to the defense that was made? What is the defense?
That's a very good question. I refer to this as a very generic defense. Unlike the situation in cases like Shifra or State versus Robertson, where the defendant's defense was that, yes, I engaged in sexual contact, but it was consensual, and the records are likely to show that my victim is suffering from a very specific mental illness that causes her to misperceive the difference between a consensual and a non-consensual encounter. For example, in Shifra, the victim had post-traumatic stress disorder, and the question was she suffering from flashbacks? Here, all we know for the defense is a very non-specific, I'm putting the state to its burden of proof. There is no indication that there is a theory as to why T.S. would falsely accuse Johnson of sexually assaulting her. In fact, that's very contrary to the facts we do have, which shows that she was not the one who came forward to the police or to investigators, but that the whole thing was triggered by Johnson's own admission out in Arizona. So you've got a very different situation here factually than you did in Schiffer or Robertson, or even in the case of a State versus Navarro, which is a court of appeals decision, where the defendant needed the records of a correctional officer to show that the defendant was acting in self-defense when he battered the officer.
Right. Well, you know, that's tied somewhat to your second issue, because if the court were to say, well, we're not going to overrule Schiffer, but we'll take the second position and do an in-camera review, then the trial court is to look and determine whether parts of the record are material to maintaining a defense. How will the court make that determination if you don't know what the defense is?
I think that's a very good point, and that is why I think in State versus Green, this court said that looking for a victim's privilege record should be the very last step in pretrial discovery, and that the court has to look at the facts that are existing at the time the request is made. That was not done here. So really, the trial court was operating somewhat in a factual vacuum, and I think the trial court, in fact, lamented the fact that there was not more evidence presented at any of the hearings. I see my time has run out, so if there's any...
You have another question.
Yes, I wanted to pick up on the trial court's lament, because my heart went out to the trial court. The trial court was faced with a difficult situation. In the trial court's opinion, he said, well, okay, there's a claim here of asserting the privilege, so preclusion of the testimony, barring the witness, testimony is one option. The state advanced doing the option of the court issuing a subpoena under 146 of the statutes. And then the judge ended up coming up with this jury instruction as a third alternative. But the judge did lament it, and he wanted the parties. He apparently felt the need for the parties at an evidentiary hearing to give him more. He says on page 27 of, I think, in appendices. It's the trial court's opinion. The trial court says, following receipt of the various briefs, this court was of the opinion that the parties to the action, the state and the defendant, as well as the non-party, should be given an opportunity to supplement the factual considerations regarding relevancy, materiality, cumulativeness, as well as the independent probative value of the court ordered Schiffer records. And this court issued an order sui sponte for a hearing to be conducted. I want more. And what happens? Folks show up and give them nothing and essentially say, do it on the motion. And then, of course, there was a statement by the non-party that the time, the dates, and the therapy providers were correct. But so here's a judge who's faced with a difficult situation and wants to know more about materiality. Your third issue is the green stuff met, or the elements of green met, following up on Justice Rosenzweig's question. And people are quiet. Give them nothing.
And I agree that I felt sorry for the trial court in that sense, but it's the defendant's burden, not the state's burden, to come forward to show how the evidence that he or she is seeking is related to the defense they intend to put on.
Other than being feeling sorry for the trial judge, my real question is what could have or should have been put on at that hearing by anyone regarding relevancy, materiality, cumulativeness, as well as independent probative value? What kind of meaningful hearing can you have other than we just rely on our motion?
I think it would have been very helpful if the trial court had had access to the forensic interview of T.S., and the trial court even mentioned that it had not looked at that. I think that would give the trial court more of a flavor for whether she made statements during the course of that forensic interview, which would have given Johnson a lot of the information that he claims he wants to get from the records. I mean, she might have admitted, the first time I told anybody about this assault was when I told my mother in January of 2011. A statement like that would have made it very easy for Johnson to say, well, obviously, if that was the first time she disclosed it, she did not tell Kristen Keeler and she did not tell Dr. Lipster back in 2010. Trial court could have, under this court's decision in State versus Green, said, defendant, I want you to give me that information, because it was something that the defense had obtained in discovery. The trial court did not apparently think it had that ability and instead was limited to whatever facts the defense chose to set out in the Schiffer motion and to whatever facts the attorney for TS stipulated to, and that included the dates on which she underwent therapy and the general purpose for which therapy was held. So I think the trial court did have at its disposal these tools but didn't take advantage of them.
What is the matter with just saying, okay, instead of saying she's barred from testifying, say she's subject to testifying. State puts the witness on, and Schiffer applies so they can't question her on it. And then you have cross-examination. What's the matter with that remedy?
I don't think anything is the matter with that remedy, because for all we know, and we don't know this because there hasn't been a sufficient effort on the part of the defense to investigate it, if they ask T.F., when is the first time you disclosed this, and she says, when I told my mother, that's exactly the type of information they are seeking from the records, the absence of any reporting in a therapeutic session.
And in Spies? We said, while we acknowledge that a victim's failure to report alleged incidents to hospital personnel has the potential to discredit the victim's testimony, so why can't the defendant here do that? State puts her on and then asks, when did you report it? To whom? And if she didn't report it, didn't report it to many people, that would discredit her.
Well, I think the point that you're making is, yes, you could get that information before the jury without even having to look at the record, but does that discredit her? I don't think it necessarily does, because I think that it's very common for children especially not to disclose sexual abuse, especially when it's from a family member, for long periods of time. Now, certainly the defense can argue the contrary before a jury in closing argument, but the state is always free to present, for example, expert testimony explaining how common this is.
At least both get to the jury and the decision is made. Can you ask if she sought psychiatric help? Is that an appropriate question?
Well, I don't think you need to here because it's already been stipulated too, and it wasn't really psychiatric help. My understanding was
counseling.
It was counseling, and for the first time she went to a counselor, I don't think it was even that she was seeking it. It was the marriage counselor for Johnson and his wife who thought it would be good to involve her.
There were two, wasn't it? One for the school and one for the
There were two sessions with the marriage counselor and then separate, I think, 12 sessions with Dr. Lipster, who was investigating her poor performance in school and to seeing how it was related to attention deficit disorder and difficulties at home.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Molley. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mark D. Richards, representing Samuel Curtis Johnson.
May it please the court. First, let me say that the defense is not seeking a right to pretrial discovery. What the defense is seeking is protection of our client's due process rights, which have been defined by the United States Constitution and this court as fundamental fairness. SHFRA, the case which has been in existence for over 20 years, meets the needs of fundamental fairness. It protects the patient's privilege and right to confidentiality in the records versus the client or defendant's rights to an effective defense. And in this case, that defense has been based upon our client's right to timely investigate, look for evidence that would aid him in putting on a complete defense to the charges. There was much questioning about what is Mr. Johnson's defense. First, the only defense, as I know, as an advocate to the charges of this type, is that it did not happen. There is no defense of mistake. There is no defense of intoxication or anything like that. This is an interfamily allegation. And I did listen to the state's procedural recitation and talk regarding this case will be over. As an officer of the court, I've had conversations with the prosecutor, Mr. Repishak, and he's made it very clear to us that he intends to go forth with this prosecution regardless of what this court does regarding barring or not barring. I don't know if that's him as an advocate, but that is what he has told the defense. In this case, when one looks at the witness preclusion remedy, that protects the interests of both parties under the law. Here, the person is making an informed decision after consultation with their attorney. They have discussed it with both of their parents, mother and father, and attorney, and decided that they do not want those private matters turned over to a judge. That was then provided to the court. And at that point, the matters were then set on for the proceeding that the court has asked many questions about and the state relies on. And at that point, there had already been a finding that we had made the preliminary Green-Schiffer showing. So we didn't know, as advocates, what else we could put on, what else we needed to put on. And if one looks at the transcripts that are in the appendix, the court, Judge Gashukevitz, spends a lot of time talking to Attorney Repishak saying, you've had your opportunity. Are you sure you don't want to put on more? This isn't a hearing to reconsider my prior ruling. That is in the transcript. And he chose to go with the record as it was then, making the remedy. The judge then entered his extensive pretrial order, which was the subject of both of the parties' appeal to the appeals court. And we had a problem with Judge Gashukevich's ruling in that it clearly ran afoul of 905.13 sub 1 and 3, commenting on a witness's assertion of privilege, sub 3 speaking to the fact that if, in fact, it is wrongfully before a jury, there is to be a curative instruction given to correct that. And when Judge Gashukevich told us that we had to draft a jury instruction putting forth this, we had a very difficult time with it in light of the case law, and both sides at that point sought to appeal. When one looks at the preliminary showing that one has to make under Green and Shifra, we have set forth all the facts that are readily available that we had. And to say that we had not done an investigation, I think, is rather fanciful. We, at this case, actually was on for a jury trial date where we were there ready to pick a jury. And at that time, the state requested an adjournment. The judge was not going to give it. And then they sought an emergency stay, and Judge Gashukevich gave the adjournment. So we were well along into the investigation. We were there for trial before the interlocutory took place in this matter. And when one...
Just so I understand your position and I don't confuse my notes for myself, I understand now that Mr. Johnson has denied that he had sexual contact with his daughter, and so that's his defense.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, as I indicated in my questions to your opposing counsel, this kind of Shifra case or cases involving in-camera inspection in sexual assault cases, in-camera inspection of records, we have had a number of them, and will so in the future. We had a case, State versus Solberg, and in that case, I wrote a concurring opinion indicating unanswered questions, and here's one of those questions in case you have not read my concurring opinion of 16 years ago. I'll share part of it with you. Here's a question. May a person waive the privilege as to a judge's in-camera review of records while still preserving the right to refuse release of the records to a defendant? I'm trying to think out of the box, and that was a question.
And I've read that opinion numerous times.
Once would have been enough.
No, it wasn't. Take my word for it. I think under the privilege law in Wisconsin, once it's waived, it's waived. And that I believe it was Solberg where even the Court of Appeals wouldn't open the envelope because they didn't know where the consent was. So in this situation that the court speaks of, it's asking, could they say, okay, the judge can look at it, and then if the judge says, I'm going to disclose, put the genie back in the bottle. And I don't think that that is a correct reading of the way the privilege statute works.
Just a general caveat to the privilege statute is, hey, if you disclose it to a third party, you no longer have the privilege, obviously. But courts generally aren't considered third parties. We're kind of party-less, you know. And so that's why I asked that question.
It would still be compelling the relinquishment of the information. And as the state and the amicus of La Casa had stated, what they're so concerned about is the breaching of that privilege and the fact that people won't come forward who may or may not be victims. And with what the state's recommending in this case is, well, if we can't have Shifra overturned, then we just subpoena it. It's still making that individual make a choice whether or not they're going to assert their privilege and when that privilege is either protected totally or not. And when one reads Ritchie, where all this started, the due process analysis, that was a trade-off. And the trade-off was that we are going to protect the privilege. We're going to limit what the advocate's eye can have. We're going to have an in-camera inspection. And then going forward, SHFRA and all the cases have come forth. The state has repeatedly argued that SHFRA was an improper extension of Ritchie because it went from government records to private records. Yet if one reads all the cases in this line, the bulk of them have to deal with private records, not government records, and that has been, that distinction has been rejected in the past. As the court said in Solberg, I believe it was your footnote, take the government out of it. The court should deal with the consent issue. They should ask the individual, do you understand how this is going to be handled, and have this on the record, explaining it to the witness whose records are being sought. And if those protections were put in place, then that individual might have a better understanding. But where it comes, the rubber meets the road, is the state's interest in wanting to go forward with the prosecution, irregardless of what the witness says. And we're not just talking always about complaining witnesses. In, I believe it was Richard A.P., they were seeking the records of a third party, the mothers who had been the driving force of the allegations and the disclosure. The court looked at that information and made a determination that some of that should be turned over to the defense. None of it was a situation here where, for some reason, the witness has refused to let the court or anyone else look at it. And if the state's position is going to be that 14682 sub 4 is the mechanism to get at those records, then the underpinning of Ritchie is gone. And at that point, we've urged the court to adopt something more of the Massachusetts or the Iowa position of letting an advocate's eye look at it. We know what the defense is. We, as advocates who are experienced in trial work, have done this. The trial court doesn't get involved until the defense has looked at the records, seen what was in them, and said, this is what we would seek to use, this is the purpose and how we would use it, and then the court rules on it after the state has made an argument contrary, if there is an appropriate argument.
Except under Green, you have to make a showing with sufficient specificity as to what's in the records that's going to help your case. Here's your motion, as I understand it, is basically she didn't report this to any of the counselors. There is nothing in the records to show that the abuse occurred. And therefore, because she didn't report it, it didn't happen.
No. Both of the doctors, the psychologist and the family counselor, were specifically dealing with interfamily issues regarding the relationship between Mr. Johnson and the complaining witness.
Right, but they, don't they have a duty? If she's reporting sexual assault, didn't they have a duty?
That is correct.
And
but
did they report? Were they the reporters?
They did not.
Right, so your inference was because they didn't report it, she didn't tell them there was a sexual assault, right?
That is part of it. But additionally, one, I can't fathom any competent counselor or doctor dealing with a relationship issue between who is now the defendant and who is now the complaining witness, asking the individual, what is the basis of the angst or the problem between you and Mr. Johnson? And when that is directly addressed, it then speaks to, was that disclosed by that person? The state wants to say, oh, well, then it can, that happens all the time. But what they're trying to do is take probative and relevant evidence away from the defense. If they wish to explain it through expert testimony after the fact and say, many children don't disclose it, that's fine. But that goes to weight, not the probativeness of it or the admissibility of it.
Okay. Am I right or wrong? Did you want the records to show that she did not report a sexual assault to the counselors?
That is one part of our argument.
Okay. What's the other part?
So
the fact that she was, we believe, asked specifically whether or not there was a basis for the problem between the relationship with her and Mr. Johnson.
What do you mean by that? If they didn't get along, there's a basis in her mind.
I didn't hear the
question. If they didn't get along, there's a basis in her mind, whether that's just, you know.
But what is the basis? Is it that Mr. Johnson is an unfair disciplinarian? Is it that Mr. Johnson favors other children more than her? Those types of things. But in a clinical situation where Mr. Johnson isn't present, she has an opportunity asked, what's the basis for the problem between you and Mr. Johnson? And nothing is said regarding him doing any untold touching, and that is the same prima facie showing that was done in Spies.
And so you want that to bolster your case. You want to say she didn't report it to the counselors, it didn't happen, right?
That is part of the argument.
That's your defense. It didn't happen. So that's not really a prior inconsistent statement. It's just a lack of...
As the trial court ruled, negative evidence is often probative. And it is a situation where these supposed sexual assaults were going on at the time. It isn't, like many of these cases, after the fact.
Was she saying that, and maybe this isn't in the record, but was she saying that she reported this to these people? I mean, was there any dispute? Could she have testified? If your point is... She didn't report it to these people, and she agrees. I didn't report it to these people. And given the fact that they didn't, as mandatory reporters, they didn't report it to the authorities, that's probably the case, right? So why not just elicit that testimony without the medical record?
How are we able to prove it? We don't know what that is.
She'd agree, presumably. I mean, if they
don't know that. And the court is asking us to walk in front of 12 jurors and hope that a witness answers truthfully and correctly. And obviously, we don't agree with that at this point. And so what we're doing is seeking out information that allows us to put on a full and fair defense. If that individual would give up her privilege, then the court could rule and we would know. And
where we're sort of missing each other is when I've had these hearings, I'm probably the only one on the bench here who has had these hearings, it requires you to come forward with more than, gosh, I just want to fish through these medical records. You do need some. Here's why I need it. Here's what I think it's going to say, and here's how it's relevant to the defense. And what I hear you saying is it's relevant to the defense because she didn't say anything about it in counseling. That's what I'm hearing you say. And given the fact that these people are mandatory reporters anyway, did you ever have a discussion with the state about stipulating to the fact that she never mentioned this in counseling?
There was never a discussion regarding stipulating with the state because we don't believe that that is appropriate at this point. We don't believe that our right to put on a defense should be impinged based upon what may or may not be in the records. We're following...
You wouldn't necessarily get the records, though. I mean, the judge would probably take them, conduct an in-camera review, and then the judge would be looking for the things that you're telling the judge you need to present your defense. And from what I'm hearing and what I think your motion says, you're saying that what you need to present your defense is to say that she never reported this to the counselors. So if the judge looks through these and finds that there's nothing that she ever said to the counselors, you still don't necessarily get the records.
Well, and at that
right?
point, if there's nothing of an exculpatory nature in the records, we wouldn't. But if she was asked by her counselor, what is the problem between you and Mr. Johnson? And she says, he's too hard on me in discipline. That is not a disclosure. It gives a reason for her potentially going forth with these allegations. That is, we're at the first step. And many of the cases that have come before the court have obviously been at the second step where the records have already been returned over. So the Court of Appeals has agreed, the trial court has agreed, that we have made a sufficient showing under the law currently, Green and Shifra. And that's all we can do short of having the records.
Okay.
Counselor, I thought, unless I'm mistaken, that all of this matter on the prosecution of Mr. Johnson started because of Mr. Johnson's statement.
Absolutely not.
Okay, well, somebody recorded it, and that's, I believe, how the
There was the initial reporting by Mr. Johnson in Arizona where he stated that he had inappropriately touched his daughter, and he does have a daughter. And that is what started everything rolling. The disclosure from the witness to the mother predates that by about, it was mid-December, and my dates might be off a little bit, but it was mid-December, and the counseling disclosure in Arizona, I believe, occurred sometime in mid to late February.
So the inappropriate touching he did was with another young woman?
No. The statement to the counselor was involving inappropriate touching of his daughter, and that's all we have. We have never seen or been provided in discovery the actual records. And that was subject of another motion in this case where we said we want to see those records before any statements are put forth, not any hearsay nature under Crawford. And the judge ruled that whoever took that purported statement of Mr. Johnson had to be present in the court in Wisconsin to give evidence.
Well, have you checked with the daughter that if he's referring to a different young woman? I would think that would be certainly an easy way of clearing this up.
I don't understand where that would lead.
Well, it certainly would put a different perspective on the reporting that occurred. But I thought the reporting was because the person that was touched was a minor. So maybe I'm just wrong on that.
That's what the state went and ran with, and that's what brings us here approximately 2 years after the fact.
Okay. That he inappropriately touched a minor female child, and you're telling me it wasn't his stepdaughter who is the main focus here, but was
daughter. I'm telling you what the disclosure that has been reported to us from the state, from Arizona, through four different entities under the mandatory reporting statute.
Okay, thank you.
One of my concerns is that this is the type of case that we see way too frequently in circuit courts around this state, or a variation of this kind of case, where there are allegations that the live-in boyfriend or the stepfather or who knows whom is having sexual contact with the 10-year-old or the 12-year-old or the 13-year-old. And so, of course, this case applies to all of those that are going on throughout the state. And one of my concerns is the potential for collusion and coercion. I understand that there is no assertion by the state at all in this case of collusion or coercion. But that potential exists in other cases around the state where mom really doesn't want little Susie to be talking about her stepfather or her live-in boyfriend. And so the best way to stop the prosecution is for mom, through the live-in boyfriend or the next-door neighbor or whoever it is, or the stepfather, to put pressure on this 12-year-old not to disclose any records. Prosecution stops in some of those cases then. That just doesn't seem like a proper balance of all the very complex balancing we have to do in this case, balancing the defendant's rights, constitutional rights, balancing the rights of the alleged victim, balancing the rights of the state and the public also. So tell me that my concerns about collusion and coercion and all these other cases are no problem.
In the broader sense, that can be a problem in any case, criminal, civil, and that is something that is looked at. The prosecution has avenues to investigate and prosecute that. In this case, because of the situation of the family, there are people who are representing the interests of that juvenile. She has her own lawyer. The mother has her own lawyer. and they have dealt with the state on numerous occasions. There is no allegation of collusion. I read it in the briefs, Your Honor, from the state, and it's what I refer to as the Chicken Little argument, and that is all these prosecutions are going to be barred. One, out of all the cases, the only one that I think ended that way is Shifra. I don't know of a whole group of cases where these cases are ending. And to believe that some mother who is going to collude with her daughter and get her to withdraw an allegation, I think it's much more likely, one, the mother wouldn't know about a Shifra remedy, but two, wouldn't let the daughter come forward to begin with. So I think that argument is a fallacy that's put forth by the government, oh, the sky is going to fall. It's not. What this does is meet the interests of the defendant to due process and fundamental fairness. And it protects a witness privilege to medical records that they do not wish to be disclosed, and they're the person who knows what's in those records more than anybody.
Counselor, the Chief Justice asked opposing counsel, what's wrong with just putting her on the stand and letting her testify and you cross-examine her? So nobody gets the records, nobody does anything, just put her on and there you go.
Clients' due process rights and rights to put on a defense have been torn away.
Why?
Because we can't ask her what happened, when it happened. We have no idea what was said in those meetings.
Why can't you ask her that question?
And if she refuses to answer or she does not answer truthfully, we have no remedy but to sit there and take the answer that she has provided and we're done.
Well, I think that's what anybody does when they're in a trial. You really are stuck with whatever the witness says, and by cross-examination, you try to get at the truth.
If you can get correct, and if you can get information and things like that that would cause that person to have the defense having more knowledge of the circumstances of the disclosure, the things that happened before, what questions were asked in treatment regarding her relationship with Mr. Johnson, those are all things that a court may look at and say, yes, this is relevant. And if, in fact, it were to go to a more open-ended area, then we as advocates could look at that with an advocate's eye, and the court would still have to rule, but it would be protected. And that is what ensures a defendant's right to put on a defense and fundamental fairness. And it is not discovery, it is due process. And I think the Chief Judge, when she was asking about the Rafe Shield, that is what this is. I thought that from the beginning. There is a friction. And it's how that friction ultimately gets resolved. But the court, and any court, is not here to say, we're going to give everybody the easy choice. Every time a court has to balance the rights of a defendant, a witness, the state, there are going to be frictions, there are going to be problems. And that's what this case, Shifra, and its 20 years of precedent has worked through. And it gives all parties a choice and the right to protect their interests if they see it fit. We have made a sufficient preliminary showing. The trial court judge knew what our defense was and was able to rule. The three judges at the Court of Appeals all agreed that we had done that. And then that witness has decided she does not wish to turn over those records. And that is why we're here today.
Well, let's just go back to your showing. My understanding is that there were two possibilities. One, that the records are absolutely silent on sexual abuse. Just silent, right?
That's a possibility.
But my understanding is that you also wanted to see whether the records showed denial of abuse.
Correct.
Which would be much stronger than just a failure to show in your opinion, or that she got along just dandy with her stepfather and not with her mother, or vice versa.
Those are all possibilities. We don't know what's in the records.
Well, it's always attorneys' position that they want to see the record free of the trial court because they know the case better and they know what they're looking for. I tend to agree with that, but the rules generally are you do it in camera anyway. Because once counsel sees the records, then those records are no longer confidential. And they're in the counsel's possession, the information. And counsel can then get more information from the information they got. So the general rule is in camera. Isn't that right?
That's clearly the law in the state of Wisconsin currently. Under Schiffer, which kind of takes a middle approach, some states are for more disclosure, some are for less.
Any state forced disclosure?
Massachusetts, if there's a showing similar to the federal rule under Rule 17 of federal procedure, making much like a Schiffer Green, showing why we believe there would be necessary records, a protective order is entered. Defense counsel is able to look at those documents with an advocate's eye. Even the judge and the state prosecutor are not allowed. And then after viewing all the things in the records with a strict protective order, not allowing to present it to even your client, then it's pled and averred why it would be relevant. And at that point, the state gets involved. So that's, I would say, the farthest on that side. And then there's other ones where they say it's highly limited and highly unattainable.
But that's what I was getting at in the beginning when I said, you know, even assuming you made the requisite factual showing under Schiffer Green, the court takes a look at these records, and the court would decide, oh, you're right, she didn't say anything to the counselor. That doesn't mean you get the records. That doesn't mean that at trial you can call through them and try to impeach what she might say with something else that's in the records. That's why you have to make the finding for the judge to go through the records to figure out, yes, this is relevant to this part of the defense. So
that's the current state of the law. There's
right,
in Wisconsin.
I know. So I'm trying to figure out what it was you expected to get, even if she turned the records over. You expected the judge to look through them and say, yep, you're right, there's nothing here.
No, I've said it, and if I'm not making myself clear, I apologize, but if she is asked what is the roots, for lack of a better term, of your problem with Mr. Johnson, and she says, I think he treats my sister better than me, I think that is a perfect chance, if a child was being sexually assaulted by Mr. Johnson, for her to say that, and that is a chance that she was given in the therapeutic setting while sexual assault was going on, and she did not put forth that he was sexually assaulting her.
Okay, so you were looking for what the root of the problem was between her and Mr. Johnson as she reported to the counselor, and that's what your motion asked for?
That's part of it, yes. The red light is on. Any further questions?
Let's take a look at your motion. I think it's on page 158. Do you know, are you able to, of your brief, memorandum in support of the motion, where with particularity have you indicated as a follow-up to Justice Ziegler's question that that's what you were looking for?
It's cited in our brief.
Page 1, your appendix, yeah. 161, is reasonably likely that information contained in counseling records is relevant and necessary.
It says at 158, she either denied or did not disclose to her therapist any sexual contact with or abuse by Johnson. When I read the motion, I read it to say you were looking for the fact that she didn't report it to the counselor. But that was...
And I guess I'm...
...the specific thing the judge was supposed to be looking for.
That and the circumstances around those questions. I don't think one can divorce themselves from the reason that is stated for the counseling, family counseling, the relationship with Mr. Johnson, Mr. Johnson's wife for marital counseling. And if the witness was not somehow a part of the problem between Mr. Johnson and Mr. Johnson's wife, why would the counselor want to see her? I think we don't have the records. We'll never have the records without an in-camera viewing other than unless the law changes. But this is what we have, what our investigation has shown, and what we believe would be relevant and probative evidence for a jury. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Moeller, you have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to first address a question about whether this prosecution can go forward if TS is precluded from testifying, because apparently the prosecutor has given mixed signals to defense counsel and to the state. Regardless of what the prosecutor's position is on that question, Johnson, in his brief, has taken the position, and I think it's on page 25, that when you have witness preclusion, it doesn't mean you just don't have the live testimony of the witness. It also means that you don't get to introduce the witness's out-of-court statements. So regardless of what Mr. Repeshak thinks the situation is, if Johnson is correct and you can't even get into out-of-court statements that would otherwise be admissible under, say, a hearsay exception and would not violate the Confrontation Clause, then I don't see how you possibly could proceed with a violation of a charge violation of 948.025 without having the victim testify. Another thing I'd like to address is a question that Justice Bradley asked regarding whether our brief indicated what the statements Johnson made in Arizona were. On page 4, under the statement of facts, and I was quoting from a motion that was actually filed by the defense to prevent the state from using Johnson's statements against him, the defense in its motion said that the report from Arizona stated that while he was undergoing treatment there, Johnson, quote, disclosed he had inappropriate sexual contact with his 15-year-old daughter. I took that to mean the same person who is the victim, the alleged victim in this case, who is actually his stepdaughter, because the ages were the same. At the time this disclosure came to light, T.S. was 15. She now is approaching the age of 18. So I took that to mean T.S. And the fact that the whole ball of the whole prosecution got rolling by virtue of an Arizona person contacting the Racine County Department of Human Services, I think is very telling, because it makes it less likely that any lack of reporting in a therapeutic session is really going to be material. And material has been defined as necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence. Would it really be necessary for a jury to know that T.S. was undergoing therapy in 2010, and in the course of the therapeutic relationship, she did not disclose that her stepfather was sexually abusing her, since she never disclosed that information to her mother until the following year? And I think it's clear that the defense has at its disposal adequate means to present this information to the jury. They could call the investigators from Racine County, who could say that the first report we ever got was the one from Arizona, which I believe Mr. Richards is saying came in maybe February of 2011. That's the first we heard of it. Well, that would mean that she had not disclosed to either Dr. Lipster or Kristen Keeler sooner, because both of those people were mandatory reporters, and the trial court certainly could give an instruction to that effect, the same as was done in a case cited in my brief, People versus Higgins, out of New York. So I think you have to look at the whole factual situation that was before the circuit court here, and not just the information that was presented in the Schiffer motion, to decide whether this type of negative information, the fact of non-reporting, would somehow be possibly material to Mr. Johnson's defense.
I want to know what other evidence the state has. I don't know what a forensic interview is. Can the interviewer testify as to what was told? I know it's hearsay, but is there an exception that the interviewer can do it?
I think it would probably be a violation of the Confrontation Clause under Crawford because...
With a testimonial.
Right, because the forensic interviewer, my understanding is, would be so aligned with the prosecution that that would be the type of testimonial statement that cannot come in without having a prior opportunity of the defense to cross-examine TS. So I think under current constitutional law, no, you could not use the interviewer's testimony to get it in that way. I see that my red light is on, so if nobody has any further questions, the state would ask this court, first of all, to either overrule SHFRA, alternatively overrule its witness preclusion remedy, or narrowly find that in this case Johnson did not make the preliminary showing of materiality. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mueller. And I thank counsel both for their arguments and for their briefs on an issue or issues that have arisen in this court before that were left open by the court in State v. Spies, including whether a guardian ad litem should be appointed for the minor, whether or not you had in-camera review is the remedy, or that the very in-camera review constitutes a waiver of the party's rights. That whether the physician-patient privilege is absolute or must be balanced with the accused right, whether you're treated differently prior to or during trial, and other questions unanswered in Spies and are before, at least maybe before the court in this case. That concludes our hearing in 11 AP 2864 CRAC, State versus Samuel Curtis Johnson III. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning when it will reconvene for oral argument. The court will meet in a closed conference at 3:15. I will see whether Justice Gableman wishes to come out. If not, another justice will, for the students. How much time do you have before the bus or otherwise?
15 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Someone will be out very promptly.